Harari English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to Harari English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Harari English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی است.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Martyr Soleimani will live on forever and his enemies will disappear in history's dustbin. January 5th, 2022.
کار رو برای خدا میکرد تظاهر نداشت لافزنی نداشت خدای متعال اولین پاداش دنیایی که به این اخلاص او داد همین تشییع 10 میلیونی بود
He would work because of God and he was free of pretentious behavior and boasting The first worldly reward that God the exalted bestowed on him for his sincerity after his being killed was his burial ceremony in which tens of millions of people participated That burial ceremony was his first worldly reward for his sincerity, and of course, there is his reward in the hereafter. The popularity of Shahid Soleimani's name, personality, and memory was his worldly reward. After the past 2 years, Martyr Soleimani's name has been repeated and written by various individuals thousands and thousands of times. This year too, people themselves have organized commemoration ceremonies for him. But as I said, I will get to this topic. These are due to the sincerity of that dear Shaheed.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Shahid Soleimani الگو شد. یکی از حقایق بسیار برجسته اینه که شهید سلیمانی تبدیل شد به یک الگو.
شهید سلیمانی became a role model. An outstanding reality is that شهید سلیمانی has become a role model. Today, many of the youth in the Islamic world and particularly in the region, the information that I have is related to the region, are thirsty for the emergence of heroes such as شهید سلیمانی. They are thirsty for such heroes. The more the memory of Shahid Soleimani is promoted, the thirstier and more enthusiastic they become for the presence of such heroes in their own countries. In our region today, Martyr Soleimani is a symbol of hope, self-confidence and courage. He is the secret to resistance and victory. These things are in the hands of God, not in the hands of anyone else. The likes of people such as us cannot accomplish such things no matter what strategy we use. Such things are done by God himself.
جریان ضد استکباری در منطقه جریان مقاومت در منطقه امروز از 2 سال پیش پر رونقتر و شادابتر و امیدوارتر داره حرکت میکنه و کار میکنه.
The anti-arrogance movement and the resistance movement in the region are moving forward in a stronger, more dynamic and more hopeful way than 2 years ago. In Syria, the enemies are faced with a dead end. The enemies in Syria have no hope for the future. These are blessings from that dear innocent blood.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You've guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
The Limelight.
A new report explains how inequality contributed to the death of 21,000 people each day of the pandemic, while the wealthiest collectively got $1.2 billion richer every 24 hours. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by John Cooley, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Billionaires Had a Terrific Pandemic While Inequality Killed Millions, Oxfam says. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Oxfam International's latest report on global inequality finds that while the 10 richest individuals in the world more than doubled their collective wealth since COVID-19 hit in 2020, the related result of this billionaire surge has been a deadlier and more prolonged pandemic for the rest of the world, in which the incomes of 99% of humanity fell. Over 160 million people were forced into poverty, and billions of the poorest were denied access to life-saving vaccines. Entitled Inequality Kills, the new report states that intense global inequality is contributing to the death of at least 21,000 people each day, approximately one person every 4 seconds, even as ultra-billionaires like Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, Mark Zuckerberg, Warren Buffett, and a handful of others grow richer and richer with each passing hour. In total, using data from Forbes, Oxfam found that the 10 richest men in the world saw their fortunes grow from an estimated $700 billion to $1.5 trillion, a rate of over $1.2 trillion per day since the pandemic hit nearly 2 years ago. Oxfam International Executive Director Gabriela Butcher said, if these 10 men were to lose 99.999% of their wealth tomorrow, they would still be richer than 99% of all the people on this planet, adding, they now have 6 times more wealth than the poorest 3.1 billion people. The outrageous wealth of these billionaires is not simply benign inequality, says the group. An economic system that allows a handful of individuals to amass such vast fortunes while billions go hungry and without proper medical care during a pandemic, according to Oxfam, is an overt act of violence aimed at huge swathes of humanity. The coronavirus pandemic has been actively made deadlier, more prolonged, and more damaging to livelihoods because of inequality, states Oxfam in the report, adding, inequality of income is a stronger indicator of whether you will die from COVID-19 than age. Millions of people would still be alive today if they had had a vaccine, but they are dead, denied a chance, while big pharmaceutical corporations continue to hold monopoly control of these technologies. This vaccine apartheid is taking lives, and it is supercharging inequalities worldwide. As the overview of the report states, the wealth of the world's 10 richest men has doubled since the pandemic began. The incomes of 99% of humanity are worse off because of COVID-19. Widening economic, gender, and racial inequalities, as well as the inequality that exists between countries, are tearing worlds apart. This is not by chance, but choice. Economic violence is perpetrated when industrial policy choices are made for the richest and most powerful people. This causes direct harm to us all, and the poorest people, women and girls, and racialized groups most. Inequality contributes to the death of at least one person every 4 seconds. But we can radically redesign economies to be centered on equality. We can claw back extreme wealth through progressive taxation, invest in powerful, proven inequality-busting people measures, and boldly shift power in the economy and society. If we are courageous and listen to the movements demanding change, we can create an economy in which nobody lives in poverty, nor with unimaginable billionaire wealth, in which inequality no longer kills. The report says billionaires have had a terrific pandemic. Butcher lamented, central banks pumped trillions of dollars into financial markets to save the economy, yet much of that has ended up lining the pockets of billionaires riding a stock market boom. Vaccines were meant to end this pandemic, yet rich governments allowed pharma billionaires and monopolies to cut off the supply to billions of people. The result is that every kind of inequality imaginable risks rising. The predictability of it is sickening. The consequences of it kill. In response to the report, Senator Bernie Sanders recently issued a simple prescription to combat the current reality. Sanders said, tax the billionaires, invest in the working class. According to Oxfam, if just the top 10 billionaires alone paid a 99% tax on their windfall profits generated during the pandemic, it'd be enough to pay for vaccines for every person in the world, universal health care, and social protection. Abigail Disney, Walt Disney's grandniece and a member of the U.S.-based Patriotic Millionaires, which advocates for higher taxes on the rich, agreed with Sanders that the solution is clear. Disney said the answer to these complicated problems is ironically simple: taxes. Mandatory, inescapable, ambitious tax reform on an international level. This is the only way to fix what is broken, she added. Without high-functioning governments actively using plentiful resources to redress these injustices, we will head yet further down the rabbit hole the wealthy class has dug for us all. There is more than enough money to solve most of the world's problems. It's just being held in the hands of millionaires and billionaires who aren't paying their fair share.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The turning point in relations, that is how the Iranian president has described his visit to Moscow. In a visit at the personal invite of the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, Raisi, who has already held a one-on-one with Putin, has said that Iran intends to enhance cooperation in a variety of fields like military and trade. In this edition of The Spotlight, Iran-Russia relations will be the focus and also a look at why Iran's president is one of the only presidents of another country to address the Russian State Duma.
Iran's president is in Russia on his most significant trip abroad since taking office in August last year. The historic visit offers the two countries a good opportunity to deepen their ties. In a meeting on Wednesday, Ebrahim Raisi and his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin agreed to work to further enhance bilateral cooperation in various fields.
We can promote our relations in the economy, trade, on the political track. We have no restrictions and nothing holds us back from further developing our ties with friendly Russia. We are not talking about momentary relations, we are talking about a sustainable and strategic relationship.
The Iranian president also said that the two nations have an exceptional opportunity to join hands to counter U.S. unilateralism and its sanctions policies.
We are living in extraordinary times when we see efforts to counter unilateral actions by the West, including the United States. We can create synergies in our efforts to work together with one another. For more than 40 years, we have been deterring the United States.
The Russian president also said that Tehran-Moscow relations have been constantly improving.
Despite the pandemic, in 2020, we had a very slight increase in trade, and last year, we saw an increase of 38%.
Tehran and Moscow share common views on geopolitical issues in West Asia, which is already facing numerous challenges, ranging from war and military intervention by some regional and extra-regional powers to economic instability. During the visit, Raisi presented Moscow with a draft version of Iran-Russia 20-year cooperation agreement. He told Putin that the document outlines a roadmap for the two countries' cooperation for the next two decades. It seems that Tehran and Moscow are on the path to capitalizing on their political solidarity and expanding relations. They are also looking for consolidating their ties with other countries in the East to build a united front in the face of the West's ever-increasing hostile agenda in the region and beyond.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, we have John Basnich. He is a journalist, activist, and political analyst who joins us from Belgrade. Also joining us, Harley Schlanger, spokesman at the La Rouche organization, who joins us from Potsdam, Germany.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. And John Basnich, I'm going to start with you. This visit by Iran's president to Russia has been deemed to be an important one, and it has come at the invitation of the Russian president, Vladimir Putin. Why is this visit considered to be as important as it's sounding to be?
First of all, it comes at the ideal time for such a meeting of leading heads of state, especially leading heads of state who are both under pressure from the United States and its NATO allies. This is a meeting that has long been awaited to take the relationship between Russia and Iran to the next higher level. And that means greater integration, greater support, and greater interreliance in opposing American dominance through unilateralism, which actually translates to the wanton use of military force.
Greater American, I think you said dominance, to push back against unilateralism, correct?
Unilateralism, and unilateralism translates into war.
Okay.
That's what we're facing from America.
So I want to take that phrase and get your reaction as to whether you agree, Harley Schlanger, with that or not, and explain a little bit further what that means, really.
Well, I agree exactly with that. The unilateral doctrine of the United States since the end of the Cold War in 1990-91 has been that America is a unipolar power, and that because the United States supposedly won the Cold War, it has a right to impose its policies on every nation. Now, what we're seeing is a rebellion around the world to that. which includes the Russian and Chinese at the leader, in the leadership of that, pushing for a Eurasian integration policy to counter the American NATO military force. Now, this is something that the American leadership, and by American leadership, I don't mean the American people. I mean the bankers, the insurance companies, the war machine that controls policy in the United States, they are intending to impose a global order based on Western financial policy. And Russia will not submit to that, China won't submit to that, and neither will Iran. So the potential exists for a counterpole to that. And the more the U.S. and NATO push toward war, the stronger the counter-alliance becomes.
It's very interesting how this military alliance is forming and being enhanced, John Busnish, in a sense, between Iran and Russia. This trip has been something that both presidents have talked about, the enhancement of their military or defensive cooperation. And it comes at a time where just days ago there was an announcement made that there's going to be Russia-Iran-Chinese war games that are going to happen. And it goes back to what you said, which comes at a pivotal time when the U.S., NATO, I mean, the U.S. should really just, the initials should be part of NATO, I guess. But anyways, the two are pushing against Russia, and the U.S. promoting this idea of war based on a false pretense that Russia has said. What does this three-way military exercise, or what kind of message does that send to the U.S.?
Well, I think that this is the smartest move that Iran, Russia, and China can continue to be making, and that is to band together to protect each other. The United States operates in a very cowardly way by attacking a lone, relatively defenseless member of the opposing side, and they decide who the opposing side is just based on the only on their own interests. And what the United States routinely tries to do, not just in military affairs but even in political affairs with its own allies like Japan, like Germany, America isolates these of its own allies who do not follow orders to the letter. Now, if that's what they do to their allies, can you imagine what they're doing to Russia, Iran, and China? And therefore, for the simple means of survival, Russia, China, and Iran are banding together, and they are creating a center of power which can only grow as more and more independent sovereign countries realize that their sovereign safe in the hands of the United States.
Well, one of the things that is a common and shared thing that Russia and Iran have, and that is the way that the U.S. sanctions has been weaponized by the U.S. against both of them. And, of course, one of the things that they both want to capitalize on is increase trade. But one of the main aims is to push for de-dollarization. They've already started that. They do their national currency and their bilateral trade, but that needs to be taken a step further, Harley Schlanger. Russia and China announced a new infrastructure for financial system to bypass SWIFT. Do you think that all of these will actually make this de-dollarization become a reality?
Well, I think the more the U.S. pushes sanctions, which in our opinion are war crimes, you know, you can kill people in some ways more efficiently by cutting off credit, by cutting off delivery of food, delivery of medicine. That's what the sanction system is. The Caesar sanctions, for example, against Syria, or the freezing of funds that belong to the Afghan people. That's the kind of dirty game the U.S. and NATO are playing. Now, it's interesting because the Germans are starting to move out from under that. There's a very important article in Handelsblatt today, the German Business Daily, which said that it would be a mistake to kick Russia out of the SWIFT system because of the damage that would do with the European trading partners of Russia and China. In the meantime, the Russia-China alliance is not just military. It's based on expanding the influence of the Belt and Road Initiative. It's based on energy, including oil and gas, but also nuclear power. And it's an ideal connection with Iran to bring Iran into the Belt and Road Initiative. I don't know if you know this, but Syria just this week signed an agreement to join the Belt and Road Initiative. The importance of the Belt and Road Initiative is that it's not controlled by the dollar, it's not controlled by London and Wall Street, and it represents an alternative approach to economics, namely investment in production, not in speculation. So I think the idea of Russia, Iran, China, maybe India will be a part of this because Putin was recently in Delhi for meetings with the Indians. You're actually beginning to see a shift away from the control of the narrative by the City of London and Wall Street and Washington toward the development of sovereign nations.
Well, you have had Iran actually try to capitalize on what it is now becoming very apparent, and that is this looking to the east. We know that the implementation looking to the east. We know that the implementation stage of the 25-year China agreement, John Basnich, was just announced days ago by the Iranian foreign minister. You have this trip that's being made by the Iranian president to Russia, which again cements their ties, especially when it comes to trade. You have Iran part of the SCO, Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which Russian president just in his bilateral meeting with Iranian president said, you know what, you also need to become one in the sphere of this Eurasian economic union. So my point being is you're having this eastward push, and that kind of doesn't in a sense show the U.S. failure in its foreign policy. We have all these countries pushing towards Russia and China and their alliances there.
You know, there's a sort of a common saying in English that goes like this. If all you've got is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And if the United States has basically only a military-industrial complex at the core of its economy, then they must push for conflict. And so long as they were the only bully on the street and that they were ready to use their forces, have support from England and France and other countries, then there was no problem for them. But now we've got Russia and China and serious military power, and we're seeing Iran developing its own national defense. I think we're going to see a real steep learning curve for the leaders of the United States here. In the past, the United States could do whatever it wanted because it did not care. Its leadership, it's a small clique that leads the United States. Its leadership had nobody to answer to because they controlled the media completely. With international media like yours, like Russia Today, like Chinese media, like other media that are coming up on the internet and on people's phones as they walk to and from work, the picture of the world is changing. And so long as America cannot control the picture of the world, they can no longer ignore what other people think of them. And this is where China, Russia, and Iran working together can show the world that solidarity can stop aggression by America.
Well, one of the places that the union of Russia and Iran proved to be very successful, Harley Schlanger, that is in the case of Syria. And when it comes to that, the message that sends the U.S. in some sense should be that they're not going to be able to help the regional countries when you have Russia and the security cooperation that exists between Russia and Iran, for example. Do you think that countries in the region are taking note of this? We know that, for example, the U.S. claims it wants to pull out of the West Asia region, or Middle East, as others call it, but others say no, it's still going to be there. But how does it look when countries see Iran and Russia enhancing their especially military ties?
Temple showed the limits of U.S. military power. The U.S. has dominated, not so much because of the military power, because outside of the large invasion force that was sent into Iraq and Afghanistan, they're using tactics such as color revolutions for regime change, sanctions, and so on. But when the Russians came into Syria and showed that they were not going to allow the United States to overthrow the Assad government, the U.S. failed. The U.S. is still there trying to take oil and impose sanctions. But what happened was it exposed the fact that the U.S. was behind the so-called Islamic terrorist movement. The so-called moderate rebels were really ISIS and Al-Qaeda, backed and trained by the U.S. Now, another example of this is what just happened in Kazakhstan, which is a very large country. It's not highly populated, but it has a lot of raw material wealth. They tried a color revolution there, including bringing in jihadists from Syria, from Iraq, and from Afghanistan. But the Russian forces came in very quickly and crushed the rebellion. And what Putin said is, we will not tolerate color revolutions. So the lesson of Syria, the lesson of Kazakhstan, and now we're seeing in Ukraine, and just a quick word on this, there are people in the United States, including inside the establishment, who are coming face to face with the reality that Putin is not bluffing, that he's very serious. He's insisting that there be security guarantees to protect the Russian people and the Russian nation. And the U.S. can threaten to kick Russia out of SWIFT. If they do that, it will harm the West. They can threaten retaliation. Who is going to take the risk of losing a country in Europe to defend a Ukrainian regime which is corrupt and includes in it neo-Nazi elements in the defense and security forces? So in this case, the Russians are holding a good, strong hand. The alliance with China makes it even stronger, because now the American military fears that if they go to war with Russia, it's going to be Russia and China. And then adding Iran, look, Iran played an extremely valuable and important role in defeating the color revolution insurgency inside Syria. Mm-hmm. And I think people in the West recognize that. And it shows that Iran, when necessary, is capable of defending the interests not only of its own country, but of the region.
So it's like pieces of this puzzle, John Bosnich, that if you put them together, it kind of shows that the U.S. is not only outstretched, but is ineffective. And I'm talking about the West Asia region, because there's also this Persian Gulf security, collective security plan that has been proposed by the Russian Federation. Iran has its own proposal also, but together, really, it's about having taking the security in their own hands in this area. Does the U.S. then is it calculating all these different things that are happening when it comes to these alliances that are getting stronger, like Iran and Russia, in how it's conducting itself in the region?
You know, I repeatedly say this when I discuss the way international political affairs are governed on America's side. I worked in Washington, and I'm very familiar with how these decisions are made. They don't actually care if they make mistakes, because the mistakes in pressuring other countries to do what they order them to do can only lead to war, which also helps the American economy, because the American economy is still a war-based economy. So they don't care about whether something is a mistake or not, because if they cause damage by pressuring a country or sanctioning a country, or if they cause damage by bombing a country, either way they're achieving their results. And this is why what they do and what they say has to be analyzed from people, especially people like myself, who was born and grew up and educated in the West and worked in government in the West and saw from the inside the criminality of the basic approach of the Anglo-American Empire. We have to speak out, because if we speak out and we join the people of Iran, the people of China, the people of Russia, and other people around the world, the loudness of our voice should be enough to wake up the American people, who are in just a deep slumber under the control of their own government.
Final question, Harley Schlanger, goes to you, and I have to ask this question, at least because our reporter said that everybody in Russia, all the reporters there in Russia, are talking about this. Chairman of the State Duma attended the inauguration ceremony of Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi, and now you have the Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi, at the invitation of Putin, one of its items on its itinerary is to address the State Duma. How important is that when you don't really recall the last time a president of another country addressed the State Duma?
Well, it's very important. I mean, it shows the degree to which Russia is looking to Iran, not just as a regional player, but as we've been discussing, as part of an alternative security architecture. One of the things Putin has been stressing is that we need to change the security architecture. And what that means is break the power of what John just called the Anglo-American Empire. Remember, the Anglo-American Empire is based on a British notion of geopolitics, which means there must never be union between European countries and Eurasia. But we're seeing now in Ukraine, we're seeing it in the so-called Middle East, a fight where countries are beginning to recognize that Eurasian integration makes sense for them. So being brought into the Duma is a very important body. Russia is emerging as a real international power. And the honor given to the Iranian president is just a reflection of the potential for this new order that's not controlled by the unipolar forces in Washington and London, but actually represents the interests of the vast majority of the world's population. So I would say this is extremely important, and would give my congratulations to the people of Iran for this kind of recognition.
Thank you very much. We're going to end it on that note. Harley Schlanger, spokesman of the LaRouche organization from Potsdam, Germany. John Boston, it's a pleasure. Thank you for your contribution. Journalist, activist, and political analyst from Belgrade. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks so much for tuning in. From Mikhail Takhavi, it's goodbye. Until the next program.
The U.S. last act in Kabul was the drone slaughtering of 7 children and 3 adult civilians with a Hellfire missile. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you, written jointly by Rebecca Gordon and Tom Engelhardt, writers. This article is published under the heading A World of Killer Robots? Stay tuned for more. Yes, it's true. After 20 years of war, actually more like 30 years if you count American involvement in the Soviet version of that conflict in 1980s, the United States has finally waved goodbye to Afghanistan, at least for now. Its last act in Kabul was the drone slaughtering of 7 children and 3 adult civilians with a Hellfire missile. And that, as Asmat Khan recently showed in a striking report in the New York Times magazine, was pretty much par for a course in this country's global so-called war on terror, that for countless civilians has distinctly been a war of terror of the most horrific sort. In those same years, this country, the United States, led the way in the use of Hellfire missile-armed drones globally, while U.S. president, any president you care to name, became an assassin-in-chief, something Donald Trump showed all too clearly when he used a drone to assassinate Iranian top commander at Baghdad International Airport in January 2020. And though Joe Biden has launched significantly fewer drone strikes so far than his predecessors, he is still been ordering them to. Worse yet, it's sadly clear that however scientific like those drones once seemed, they are still piloted by actual human beings, even if from far, far away. As such, they represent a relatively early stage in the process of fully automating weapon systems on land, on sea, and in the air, and the decision-making that goes with them. And here's a scenario to consider. A military force has purchased 1 million cheap, disposable flying drones, each the size of a deck of cards, each capable of carrying 3 grams of explosives, enough to kill a single person or, in a shaped charge, pierce a steel wall. They have been programmed to seek out and engage kill certain human beings based on specific signature characteristics like carrying a weapon, say, or having a particular skin color. They fit in a single shipping container and can be deployed remotely. Once launched, they will fly and kill autonomously without any further human action. Science fiction? Not really. It could happen tomorrow. The technology already exists. In fact, lethal autonomous weapon systems or LAWs have a long history. Washington faced quite a few strategic problems in prosecuting its war in Indochina, including the general corruption and unpopularity of the South Vietnamese regime it was propping up. Its biggest military challenge, however, was probably North Vietnam's continual infiltration of personnel and supplies on what was called the Ho Chi Minh Trail, which ran from north to south along the Cambodian and Laotian borders. The trail was in fact a network of easily repaired dirt roads and footpaths, streams and rivers lying under a thick jungle canopy that made it almost impossible to detect movement from the air. The U.S. response, developed by Jason in 1966 and deployed the following year, was an attempt to interdirect that infiltration by creating an automated battlefield composed of four parts. Analog to a human body's eyes, nerves, brain, and limbs. The eyes were a broad variety of sensors, acoustic, seismic, even chemical for sensing human urine, most dropped by air into the jungle. The nerve equivalents transmitted signals to the brain. However, since the sensors had a maximum transmission range of only about 20 miles, the U.S. military had to constantly fly aircraft above the foliage to catch any signal that might be tripped by passing North Vietnamese troops or transports. The planes would then relay the news to the brain, originally intended to be remote controlled. Those aircraft performed so poorly that human pilots were usually necessary. And that brain, a magnificent military installation secretly built in Thailand's Nakhon Phanom, housed two state-of-the-art IBM mainframe computers. A small army of programs wrote and rewrote the code to keep them ticking as they attempt to make sense of the stream of data transmitted by those planes. The target coordinates they came up with were then transmitted to attack aircraft, which were the limb equivalents. The group running that automated battlefields were designated Task Force Alpha, and the whole project went under the codename Igloo White. As it turned out, Igloo White was largely an expensive failure, costing about $1 billion a year for 5 years, almost $40 billion total in today's dollars. The time lag between a sensor tripping and munitions dropping made the system ineffective. As a result, at times, Task Force Alpha simply carpet-bombed areas where a single sensor might have gone off. The North Vietnamese quickly realized how those sensors worked and developed methods of following them from plane truck ignition recordings to planting buckets of urine. Given the history of semi-automated weapon systems like drones and smart bombs, in the intervening years, you probably won't be surprised to learn that this first automated battlefield couldn't discriminate between soldiers and civilians. In this, they merely continued a trend that's existed since at least the 18th century, in which wars routinely kill more civilians than combatants. None of these shortcomings kept Defense Department officials of the United States from regarding the automated battlefield with awe. Andrew Cockburn described this worshipful posture in his book Kill Chain, The Rise of the High-Tech Assassins, quoting Leonard Sullivan, a high-ranking Pentagon official who visited Vietnam in 1968. Quote, just as it is almost impossible to be an agnostic in the Cathedral of Notre Dame, so it is difficult to keep from being swept up in the beauty and majesty of the task force Alpha Tembo, unquote. Who or what, you well might wonder, was to be worshipped in such a temple? Most aspects of that Vietnam-era automated battlefield actually required human intervention. Human beings were planting the sensors, programming the computers, piloting the airplanes, and releasing the bombs. In what sense, then, was that battlefield automated? As a harbinger of what was to come, the system had eliminated human intervention at a single crucial point in the process, the decision to kill. On that automated battlefield, the computers decided where and when to drop the bombs. In 1969, Army Chief of Staff William Westmoreland expressed his enthusiasm for this removal of the messy human element from war making. Addressing a luncheon for the Association of the U.S. Army, a lobbying group, he declared, on the battlefield of the future, enemy forces will be located, tracked, and targeted almost instantaneously through the use of data links, computer-assisted intelligence evaluation, and automated fire control. With first-round kill probabilities approaching certainty, and with surveillance devices that can continually track the enemy, the need for large forces to fix the opposition will be less important. What Westmoreland meant by fix the opposition was kill the enemy. Another military euphemism in the 21st century is engage. In either case, the meaning is the same. The role of lethal autonomous weapon systems is to automatically find and kill human beings without human intervention.